WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Supreme Court has in the past few years changed direction. Turning Right is the name of a new book about the making of the Rehnquist Supreme Court. My guest is the author, David Savage, who covers the court for the Los Angeles Times. Rehnquist became Chief Justice in 1986, and since then, four new conservative justices have been appointed. Savage writes, "Gone is the court majority that breathed new life into the Bill of Rights, dismantled Southern segregation, disciplined police who violated the rights of citizens, removed religion from the public schools, and swept aside laws forbidding women to end their pregnancies." The Supreme Court will soon hand down its ruling on a Pennsylvania state law restricting a woman's right to abortion. This morning, Savage attended a Senate committee hearing on a bill that could keep abortion legal even if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade.
Well, the Senate and the House are considering the Freedom of Choice Act, which would allow Congress to protect abortion rights if the Supreme Court should overturn Roe v. Wade this year or next. It would essentially write into national law a provision that says states may not restrict a woman's right to get an abortion before the point of viability of a fetus.
Now, President Bush would likely veto such a bill if it passed.
He certainly would veto it. He's said that several times. And I have to say this is, at this point, a way to raise the political issue even higher. The Democrats are planning on, if the court in late June restricts or overturns Roe, to quickly pass this bill about the time of the political conventions in July and August and force the president to veto it. And that would make the issue very clear for the November elections. Governor Clinton has said he would sign such a bill and support it. I believe Ross Perot would support it, and George Bush would not. He would veto it.
This was a Senate committee hearing this morning. What
That's
was the
correct.
Actual function of today's meeting?
They were holding a hearing on discussing whether this bill was constitutional. There's at least some doubt as to whether Congress has the authority to create a new right. If the Supreme Court says there's no such right, it's not clear that, at least there's some debate on whether Congress can create a new right and say there is this right. The Bush administration has the view that abortion is not covered by the Constitution, and Congress has no ability to intervene in this area. This is a matter for the states to decide.
How does it look to you?
Well, I it's an interesting question. I don't know how it would be. This would become a very significant question should Governor Clinton get elected and Congress would pass this, let's say Congress would pass this law, Clinton would sign it into law, and there would be a national statute on the books that says the states may not restrict the right to abortion. And one of the states could then challenge this in the Supreme Court and say, look, there's nowhere in the Constitution where Congress is given the power to regulate in this area. And so it would be another difficult dispute before the Supreme Court. A conservative Supreme Court could actually strike down a national law creating a right to abortion, and that would be quite an interesting constitutional clash.
Let's get to the subject of your book, The New Supreme Court. You say that the Supreme Court under Rehnquist doesn't see itself as the defender of civil rights and civil liberties, the champion of the individual. Now it sees its duty as upholding the will of the majority. Would you explain that fundamental difference?
Sure. The Supreme Court gets cases usually where someone is coming before the federal court saying, I have a constitutional right to do something. Let's say in this case, and we were talking about abortion, a woman says, I have a fundamental right to choose abortion in some state, for example, Louisiana, Utah, or in the case of the original Roe case, Texas, saying, no, you do not. Abortion is a crime in our state. And so the question for the Supreme Court is, do we act and strike down that law as violating the Constitution, violating a woman's fundamental rights, or do we defer to the lawmakers in the states and say, we will uphold this law and and not give force to the individual right. So almost every constitutional case, you get that situation where an individual is on one side saying, I have a fundamental right to do this, and some aspect of the government, a prosecutor, the police, a state legislature, the federal government saying, no, you don't. This is the power of the government. So it's almost always a clash of the power of the government versus the rights of an individual. The liberal court during the Warren era in the 60s and 70s was much more inclined to read the Bill of Rights broadly and say that individuals have rights of all sorts and that the government may not infringe those rights. The Rehnquist Court is now heading the other way, saying we're going to defer to the powers of government, states, city councils, school boards. If I think, for example, if a school board would want to impose some sort of prayer or Bible reading in the schools, the Supreme Court would be much more inclined now to say, you may do that. That's a power to be decided by a state legislature or a local school board. It's not a matter of an individual right.
Rehnquist used to be called the Lone Ranger because when he came on the court a little over 20 years ago, he was the lone conservative in a court of moderates and liberals. What gave him the reputation as an extremist then?
He fundamentally disagreed with all sorts of areas of constitutional law that had become accepted. As I mentioned, the separation of church and state principle. He's always disagreed with the criminal rights decisions like the Miranda decision or very strict decisions limiting the police power to search and seize evidence. On the First Amendment, he's been always inclined to say that the government can restrict pornography or all sorts of areas that some of the more liberal members of the court thought were protected under the First Amendment. So during those eras, in the 60s and 70s, he was viewed by at least liberals as an extremist. In fact, I would use the parallel of Ronald Reagan. If you ask somebody in 1965 or 1968 about Ronald Reagan, a lot of people would have said, well, my goodness, he's a nice fellow, but he has very extreme conservative views. Well, by 1980, he was the president of the United States, and at least some people had changed their view of him. Rehnquist was viewed as an extremist in the 60s and early 70s when he first came to the Supreme Court, and he's now the dominant figure on the court, largely because of Ronald Reagan.
A couple of other stands that Rehnquist took that I think might be relevant to that view of him as an extremist is he argued against Brown versus the Board of Education. He opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He's opposed the Equal Rights Amendment. You say that he made the statement that the ERA would turn wedlock into holy deadlock.
Yes, he opposed it. That's when he was an attorney in the Nixon administration. He was opposed to the then pending Equal Rights Amendment. On the 1964 Civil Rights Act, I had recounted a scene in the book in the city of Phoenix where he lived, and he was a 39-year-old attorney. The city council had been somewhat embarrassed the year before, in 1963, that there was a national convention of attorneys there, and one of the premier resort hotels in the city didn't allow Jewish overnight guests. So the Phoenix City Council decided to pass a public accommodations law that said essentially that no person may be restricted in his right to enter motels, hotels, restaurants, drugstores, whatever, because of race, religion, or color. This was several months before Congress passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And Rehnquist, representing no client, just speaking for himself, went down to the city council one night and said that he thought that was a mistake, that this was a matter of fundamental freedoms and that the city council should not try to tell hotel owners or drugstore owners who they can serve and who they cannot serve. He was very concerned about the, as he said, the freedom of the individual. I think it also shows, though, he was not particularly concerned about the freedom of, say, black persons to go to a restaurant or stay overnight in a hotel in Phoenix. And he's had that. Now, I should say, for the record, I don't think he'd take that position today. I think he made clear in his confirmation hearings that he now accepts the fact that the 1964 Civil Rights Act was a good thing and has been a good thing for the country. He certainly accepts the Brown versus Board of Education decision. But in 1952, when he was a young law clerk, he had written memos essentially arguing that the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which allowed separate but equal and segregation throughout the South, was a longstanding decision and should not be changed now by the Supreme Court.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Savage. He covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times, and he's written a new book called Turning Right, The Making of the Rehnquist Supreme Court. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Supreme Court with journalist David Savage, who covers the court for the LA Times. Why do you think Ronald Reagan chose Rehnquist to replace Warren Burger as the Supreme Court Chief Justice?
I think Ronald Reagan knew very little about Chief Justice Rehnquist, but he had at the Justice Department, of course, Attorney General Ed Meese, and Meese had, working for him, a young clerk named, a former Rehnquist clerk named Charles Cooper, who had risen up to be a fairly high official of the Justice Department, and he and Brad Reynolds thought very highly of Rehnquist. Rehnquist was for that small circle of Washington attorneys who were ardent conservatives and had followed the court very closely for many years. Rehnquist was a real hero, sort of like Robert Bork was to a certain group. They pushed for Rehnquist's nomination. They said he'd be the ideal Chief Justice, and he's been a very successful leader of the court because he's a person of clear views, and also he's a very likable. He's a very genial, very down-to-earth. He doesn't have any sense of arrogance or pomposity. And it is, after all, a fairly small group. There are nine justices who meet behind closed doors. They work together very closely. And while their job requires sitting around and arguing about a lot of tough issues, in the end you have to get along with the people. And Rehnquist, I think, has done a very good job that he doesn't allow any of the legal disputes to become real personal animosities. You never hear among any of the justices about so-and-so hates somebody else, and there's not a lot of backbiting and even maneuvering the way there was on the Burger Court in the late 70s. The Brethren, which came out in the late 70s, recounted a lot of the bitter infighting in the Supreme Court. I think there's very little of that now. There are legal disagreements, but Rehnquist is such a, as I say, sort of a down-to-earth and genial fellow that even though the justices some of them disagree very strongly on legal matters, it doesn't become a bitter personal set of feuds among the justices.
Do you think there are any fundamental differences between Rehnquist and the new generation of conservatives on the court?
There's one difference that I noticed that I think it would be interesting to see how it plays out in the years ahead. I think the new, younger generation of conservatives is much more are much more supporters of the freedom of speech. There was a time in the late 60s, for example, when freedom of speech seemed to be a liberal cause, the Vietnam protests and civil rights demonstrations, and conservatives talked about law and order. I think in the 1980s, when freedom of speech became more abortion picketers and protesting against communism in Eastern Europe, many of the young conservatives are ardent proponents of freedom of speech because I think they think their ideas are better and they should be heard. And Justice Scalia and Kennedy, in particular, are strong supporters of the freedom of speech. And that was seen most vividly in the flag-burning case. Scalia and Kennedy, who were Reagan's second and third appointees, provided the majority to strike down the flag-burning laws on the grounds that this was a type of political protest. It was an act of political protest and therefore an act of free speech to stand up, let's say, on the steps of a city hall and burn a flag. Rehnquist took his more characteristic view of saying there's nothing in the Constitution that forbids this. A flag is a sacred symbol for many Americans. Millions of American soldiers have died for the flag, and Congress and the states certainly have the power to make it a crime to burn a flag.
Let me paraphrase something that you say in your book. You say that Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan were the last liberals. Now the most liberal members are Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens, both moderate Republicans. So how moderate or liberal are they?
It's something in the eye of the beholder. When they came on the court in the early 70s, Blackmun in 1970 and Stevens in 1975, they were seen as part of the Nixon-Ford court of being, for example, more conservative on crime. One of the big issues in the Stevens confirmation in 1975 is, was the death penalty unconstitutional? Stevens was willing to uphold the death penalty, as was Blackmun, at least as a matter of principle, and so therefore they were seen as moderate conservatives. But they were also strong supporters of the right to abortion. Blackmun, as you know, was the author of the Roe decision, and Stevens has also been a strong proponent of that right. So these days, they are viewed as, you know, as part of the liberal left wing of the court.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see Sandra Day O'Connor fitting in politically into the Rehnquist court?
She is, I would say, again, something of a moderate conservative. She's not with Rehnquist and Scalia as being a sort of an ideological, consistent conservative on every issue. Sandra O'Connor is a little bit like Lewis Powell, the justice who retired in 1987, is that she finds many of these cases very difficult and agonizes over them and doesn't say it's either black or white. She tends to write opinions that, for example, she would, on the religion area, she would allow more religion in public life. I think, for example, she would allow the creche on the in the city park as a Christmas display. She would not say, oh, you can't do that because it's a religious symbol. But she would certainly not go as far as the Chief Justice would and allow prayer in schools, because she said, once you cross the line where the government is endorsing religion, you're going too far. The government may not endorse religion. So she, more than any member of this current court, tends to draw a very fine line. She sort of finds a middle position and sticks to it, but she's not easily put into one camp or the other. I think you may have heard, there's always been a lot of discussion on her view on the abortion issue. She's the one member of the court who would join the conservatives to say that states may regulate abortion. For example, that they may impose a 24-hour waiting period or something of that sort. But she will not join the conservatives, I would predict, in allowing Roe versus Wade to be overturned entirely and saying states may make abortion a crime. She's tried to draw sort of a middle position that states may regulate, but they may not ban abortion.
Justice Scalia has accused her of being political in the way that she's made some of her decisions, particularly some of her decisions about abortion. Well, what does he mean by that?
Well, Scalia, I think, is very much the view that the law is an intellectual exercise, that the Supreme Court should draw clear lines. It's either right or wrong. Either, for example, that the Supreme Court has the power to regulate abortion and pass all kinds of regulations, or it has no power at all. And Scalia says it has no power at all. The Supreme Court has no authority to touch the issue of abortion. It's a black and white issue for him. He will frequently say it's not a matter of justice, it's not a matter of what I think is right or wrong, it's a matter of what the law says. And he's very much a black and white, right or wrong. And he finds he constantly clashes with Justice O'Connor, and a lot of us are intrigued by that, because she too has fairly conservative views, moderate conservative views, but she doesn't see these issues as black and white, yes or no. She tends to, as I said, to write opinions that are more moderated, that draw a finer line, that said maybe yes in some situations, maybe no in others, and that, for some reason, really irritates Scalia.
Where do you see Clarence Thomas fitting in within the political spectrum represented on the Supreme Court?
So far, all we know is that he's very far on the right. He's written several decisions that have been, several concurring opinions that have been to the right of Chief Justice Rehnquist, which I think is means he's fairly conservative. But I will say, you know, he's very young. He's only 43 years old, and it'll be interesting to see whether he changes or evolves over time. I think he doesn't have a very clear, well-thought-out view of the law. But he did state fairly conservative views when he was in the Reagan and Bush administrations, and he was very badly hurt, I think, by all the attacks on him during the confirmation hearings, and most of his clerks that have gone to work for him are young conservatives. So he's, at this point, only, from what I understand, only hearing one side of a lot of issues.
Do you have any idea what the arguments between the justices are like now, what the dynamics are between the justices on the abortion issue?
Well, I don't, because it's behind closed doors, but I will say I've been surprised when I've talked to them before how little they argue about these issues. I've talked to some of the justices who have been there for a long time, and I said, well, what do you think, where do you think Justice O'Connor will come down in the end? And Some of them who sat around the table with her for 15 years say, I really don't know. We talk about these in a fairly brief, narrow discussion. We make our points and then move on. They cast their votes. And so I think you might be surprised if you were able to put a microphone in that conference room that they are not either prolonged arguments or deep debates. Scalia complains about this a lot. They tend to go, each of them takes 30 seconds or a minute to announce his view of the case, and here's how I'm going to vote. They go around and they count up the votes, and that's how it is. They don't sit at the table and argue back and forth with each other.
When you look at the Supreme Court and at the future of American laws interpreted by the Supreme Court, are you worried by what you see?
Well, I suppose I could be worried in the sense of, I think it's fairly clear what the direction of this Supreme Court is. It's not clear what the destination is. What I mean by that is that this court is inclined to give prosecutors, police, government officials more power. And I suppose I do worry sometimes, where does that stop? For example, last year they upheld a search and seizure of a person traveling on a Greyhound bus. The police got on the bus down in Fort Lauderdale and walked down the aisles and asked everybody to look in their bags and try to find drugs. And the court upheld that. Well, what would you think if the police in the town you lived in came into the restaurants routinely and said, I want everybody to stand up and I'd like to look through your purses and bags and wallets? Or they did that on airplane aisles. You know, where does that stop? And I think the concern I have for the future is whether this court will at some point in those areas say, the police can't go any further than this and prosecutors can't do this. That goes too far. That would be fundamentally unfair. It'll be an interesting thing to see in the next 5 years whether this court is willing to draw some lines and say, okay, we're going to give the police more authority than before, but this is as far as they can go. They can't go beyond this.
David Savage, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. Enjoyed it.
David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and has written a new book called Turning Right, The Making of the Rehnquist Supreme Court. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.